This is the Voice of America, Studio One.
They had what I would call a survival type pattern of life.
Finally, the Russians found out that there was a shortage of ammunition within the fort and that the Indians were trying to replenish this. This is when they requested a showdown.
We didn't know that there was gold up here in any substantial quantity. So I suppose it's a fair statement to say that several different interests finally got together to promote the purchase of Alaska by the United States.
Alaska, the last frontier. A special program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the purchase of Alaska by the United States. Today, the first of a series of four programs about the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the colorful 49th state. Here is Rhett Turner.
Alaska, a land so cold that breath freezes into ice crystals as you exhale, and as hot and dry as a desert. Wild animals and trackless wilderness, the land of Eskimos and Indians, mountains and moose, mucklucks and mackinaws, boots and bears, and that other thing that has given many a man that faraway look in his eye, gold. This is the Alaska we've all heard about, the land where Eskimos have lived for thousands of years under conditions so severe that most men would perish. The cruel land that lured thousands of prospectors during the great gold stampedes. The land of intense cold, the treacherous, unbearable cold that killed the weak and crippled the strong. It's all there, even today, and so much more. The beginning was some 10,000 years ago when a tiny sliver of land stretched across what is now the Bering Strait, joining North America and Asia, Alaska and Siberia. Sometime in those ages past, a hardy people of Mongolian descent migrated across this land bridge into the Americas. The Arctic Eskimos are descendants of those people, as it is believed are the American Indians to the south. In their aboriginal state, the Eskimos and Alaska Indians lived and survived through the most extreme conditions anywhere on Earth.
They had what I would call a survival type pattern of life.
Tom Brower, a native Eskimo from Point Barrow.
And they would work together and hunted together and hunted and fished so they would have their food supply as one. The coastal native people hunted the bowhead whale mainly in the spring and in the fall, and then during the summer they would also hunt the walrus, the seal, and the caribou.
But another beginning came in 1741 when Danish sailor Vitus Bering, exploring for Tsar Peter the Great of Russia, discovered this fabled North Country. Natives in the Aleutian Islands called it Alaska, the Great Land, and so it proved to be. Bering himself didn't survive that trip of discovery, but his sailors took back 1,000 fur pelts they'd traded from the natives. The fur included highly prized sea otter pelts, and when they were delivered to a Russian-Chinese trading post in Asia, it wasn't long before Russian fur traders were swarming along the southern coast of Alaska. In 1776, as the American colonies declared their independence and began the American Revolution, Captain James Cook of England explored Alaska's coastline and rivers looking for the fabled Northwest Passage. And by 1787, Russia had established the first permanent settlement at Kodiak on an island south of the Alaska mainland. The Eskimos of the coast to the north continued to roam the frozen tundra and the ice of the Arctic Ocean, hunting seal, walrus, and caribou, catching whales, and fishing. Native Aleuts fished and trapped along the Aleutian Island chain that stretches out toward Asia. Inland, the Athabascan Indian tribe lived and hunted in the Arctic Mountains and along the Yukon River. The richest of Indian civilization, the Tlinkets, lived in the southeast coastal regions of Alaska and western Canada. It is here in the southeast coastal region that Alaska seems most familiar and breathtakingly beautiful. Green-covered islands are scattered along deep blue fjords, reminiscent of those in Norway. There are protected channels for big vessels. To the east, in spring and summer, only the peaks of tall mountains are covered with snow, and centuries-old glaciers stream down from aged ice caps. Ferries now ply this inviting inside passage. Then on an island jutting out into the Pacific, a snow-capped volcano that looks like Japan's Fujiyama, and Sitka, the historic capital of the Russian-American colony. This is where Alexander Baranov, the most famous manager or governor of the Russian-American Company, established his capital in 1799.
In 1795, Alexander Baranov, expecting the need, anticipating the need to move south from Kodiak, sent an expedition here to reconnoiter the area around southeast Alaska and in Sitka in particular.
Mrs. Romaine Hardcastle, a historian who lives in Sitka today.
They liked the location of Castle Hill best. Castle Hill is a prominent area in downtown Sitka. It looked out over the sea. It was a very outstanding location so far as controlling the surrounding area, the surrounding islands. This hill, however, was occupied already by the Kiksadi clan of Tlinkit Indians. The Russians needed the cooperation of these Indians if they were to move here, because they needed the Indians as trappers for their fur trade. So they did not want to be at odds with them, so they selected a second best location, which was 6 miles north of Sitka. In 1799, the Russians, headed by Alexander Baranov, came into the area, arrived at Old Sitka, had parley agreements, talks with the Kiksadi clan of Tlinkit people who lived in the area, and they were given permission to establish a fort at Old Sitka. This was in 1799.
By 1800, the Russian-American Company had expanded its trading and fur trapping from the Aleutian Islands around to the southern coast of Alaska and down the coast of California. Sitka was a mild, comfortable, and ideal spot for a capital. It didn't get so cold here in the wintertime. The Russians had used native Aleuts as hunters when they moved into their islands. They weren't so fortunate with the Tlinkit Indians when they came to the southeast.
The fort was attacked 2 years later, or 1802, by the Kiksadi clan of Tlinkit people. The survivors were picked up by a Britisher and returned to Kodiak Island. Baranov was not present in the colony at the time. He had gone back to Kodiak. Then it was 2 years after that, in 1804, that the Russians again returned to Sitka. The Indians seemed to realize that the Russians would not give up this easily, that they would be back. And so within this 2 year period, they fortified what had been a fish camp at Indian River with the intention of, upon the return of the Russians, rather than resist them from their Castle Hill position, they would resist them, if it came to that, from the very fine location of the fort at Indian River.
The Indians had learned to use firearms and had bought guns and ammunition from British and American traders who also visited the Southeast Alaska Territory. Their fort was well placed beyond a tidal flat which kept Russian ships in deep water out of cannon range. Romaine Hardcastle, standing on the site of the fort, explained to me how the battle went.
the Indians had sent a canoe out to the surrounding islands to collect their caches of ammunition and bring them to the Indian River Fort. One of the Russians took a pot shot, you might say, at this large canoe crossing the channel, not realizing what was in it. The canoe contained the ammunition, the gunpowder, that the Indians had been collecting over this two-year interim. One of the Indians in the canoe fired back, and in so doing, a flint from his rifle dropped into the powder keg, one of the kegs in the canoe, and blew it up. So their major supply of ammunition was lost before the beginning of the battle.
Then fighting erupted between the Russians and the Indians.
They held out for 7 days, actually, on the meager supply of ammunition that they had and on the spent shot of the Russians. At low tide, they would go out and pick up the Russian cannonballs that had fallen short of their mark at the fort. And when the Russians would move in at high tide, the Indians, using their own cannon, would fire them back. Finally, the Russians found out, and after 6 days, they found out that there was a shortage of ammunition within the fort and that the Indians were trying to replenish this. This is when they requested a showdown. And this is when the Russians said that they were going to attack the fort the following morning. When the Indians realized it was not possible to replenish their supply of ammunition, they simply evacuated. Rather than make an arrangement with the Russians, or rather than submit to Russian control or give their permission for the Russians to establish here, they simply evacuated the area. When the Russians attacked the fort the following morning, it was empty.
So Baranov and the Russian-American Company established their permanent capital at Sitka and extended their trading around the whole southern coast of Alaska and the northwestern coasts of Canada and the United States. For 50 years, the fur trapping and trading flourished until a combination of circumstances brought the eventual purchase of the territory by the United States. Throughout the early 1800s, the fever for gold had not yet afflicted men who explored the Yukon and Alaska. The Russians saw some gold but were not excited about it. A Church of England minister in the Yukon had seen gold in 1830 but did nothing about it. Gold had been discovered in California, but the explorers of the North seemed more interested in other things. Just a few miles east of Sitka, on another deep inland channel, is Juneau, today's capital of the state, Alaska. There, one of Alaska's most prominent historians, Bob DeArmond, told me how the United States first became interested in the territory.
Well, the first interest was back in the very early 1800s by fur traders from Boston and Salem and New York who came out here and purchased furs from the Indians and did some trading with the Russians. And there was an American shipbuilder, an American named Lincoln, who came to Sitka and built ships for the Russians there. But a little later than that, the first Americans who actually came to Alaska and explored it were part of the Western Union Telegraph Expedition in 1865 and 66, who sent a man named Robert Kennicott to explore up here with the idea of extending a telegraph line from the then United States, the area east of the Mississippi, to reach Europe by way of Siberia. And that expedition did some extensive exploration along the Yukon River and right northward from the Canadian boundary, actually, to into Siberia. They had parties in Siberia also.
Was this the first exploration of the interior of the country?
To any large extent, they were the first people, I believe, who established that the Yukon and the Kvitchak were one river. The upper part of the river that we now call the Yukon was called in the Indian dialect, the Athapascan Indian, the Yukon. And at the mouth of the river, the Eskimos called it the Kvitchak. Most maps showed the Yukon flowing northward into the Arctic Ocean on a parallel course with the Mackenzie River, while the Kvitchak was supposed to have been a completely separate river system.
Alexander Baranov, governor of the Russian-American Company, could do little about the incursions of American traders and British ships in the vicinity of southeast Alaska. There were times when Sitka and other colonies in the area almost starved. Shortly after 1805, a military post and agricultural colony was established hundreds of miles to the south in the rich soil of California, where weather conditions were more favorable for growing food crops. By 1844, the fur-bearing animals along the Alaska coast were almost exterminated, and questions were being raised in Russia about the future of the distant colony. Imperial Russia's fleet was badly outclassed by the British, and her internal weaknesses were evident after Russia's collapse in the Crimean War in 1856. These, among other reasons, prompted Russia to make a quiet overture to the United States for sale of the Russian America territory. The Russian minister to Washington, Baron Edward de Stekel, in 1856 was instructed by the Grand Duke Constantine to see if the United States was interested in buying. But the United States had problems of its own, the American Civil War, and it was not until 1866 that the atmosphere was again ripe for the great real estate transaction. I asked historian Bob DeArmond why the United States decided to purchase Alaska.
Well, that question's a little difficult to answer, but there were a good many different factors. For one thing, Secretary of State William H. Seward had an interest in expanding the whole United States. He was interested way back at the time of the Civil War in purchasing Greenland and purchasing the Virgin Islands and other islands in the Caribbean. And there were some negotiations between Russia and the United States during our Civil War. The Russians sent a fleet to San Francisco Bay during the Civil War. They sent another fleet to New York Harbor. The whole purpose of that is not known today, but presumably it was a kind of an offset to England's interest in the South. Aside from that, there were commercial interests in California. Some people interested in the cod fishery in the North Pacific, others interested in the furs. There may have been some interest in coal. So far as I know, there was no interest at that time, and this is the middle Civil War period, in gold. We didn't know that there was gold up here in any substantial quantity. So I suppose it's a fair statement to say that several different interests finally got together to promote the purchase of Alaska by the United States.
Stekel received careful instructions from St. Petersburg on exact terms under which the proposed sale was to be made. He was told to insist that the property rights and freedom of religion of Russian citizens in Alaska be respected, and that after the purchase was completed, the people there be given the choice of remaining or returning home. The sale was to provide that during the transition period, the United States should assume the Russian-American Company's obligations to feed, clothe, and house those who decided to stay. Also, that the Americans honor a commitment to the Hudson's Bay Company lease in southeastern Alaska. And there was one more stipulation laid down by St. Petersburg, that Minister Edward de Stekel was to accept no less than $5 million for the Alaska Territory. Stekel first asked Secretary of State William H. Seward $7 million, and when he realized that Seward had his heart set on getting Alaska, Stekel held out for his price. To quiet Russian misgivings about the Russian-American Company's contract obligations, Seward offered to advance the price another $200,000. Russia accepted, and Seward then proceeded with one of the greatest political battles of his life. The whole idea was labeled Seward's Folly by those who opposed purchasing the vast frozen wasteland of the North. With the persuasive assistance of Minister Edward de Stekel and the support of Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts and Congressman Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, Seward finally got congressional approval and later appropriations for the purchase. $7,200,000 for what has come to be called the greatest real estate deal in history. The purchase treaty was signed on March 30, 1867, and on the afternoon of October 18, 1867, on the site of Castle Hill in Sitka, a formal ceremony transferred Alaska from Russia to the United States. From today's jetliner, you may look down on the Juno ice cap, the long blue Lynn Channel up to Dyea and Skagway. There below, Chilkoot Pass and the White Pass, the route followed by the great Gold Stampede. It looks tame today, but it wasn't so 100 years ago. After the United States purchased Alaska, very little was done with the new land until Canadian prospectors found gold in British Columbia in 1874. Then in 1880, a prospector named Joe Juno and his partner Richard Harris discovered gold near the site of the town which today bears Juno's name. I asked Bob DeArmond just what did set American prospectors on fire. What brought the hordes of men up from the lower 48 to begin the Alaska and Yukon gold rush?
Well, there was a lot of gold here at Juno, and a lot of wealth was taken out, but it didn't bring a lot of people. From Juno, they went into the Yukon. They found gold on the 40-mile river in 1886, and that brought perhaps 500 more prospectors north. In 1894, they found gold at Circle City, and that brought some more. And then in late 1896, gold was found on the Klondike River in Canada, in the Yukon Territory. And that really set it off.
During that period, after the American Civil War, there was an economic depression throughout most of the United States. And for men worried about where the next dollar was coming from, the thought of digging a shovel into the earth or sifting a pan of muck and getting rich quick was overwhelming. And there was still another small event of fate which seemed to play a part.
It was partly publicity in Seattle, I think. A newspaper reporter there got the idea for a lead saying a ton of gold had arrived from Alaska on the steamer Portland. And where $1 million in gold didn't sound like a million, different from $1 million in greenbacks or $1 million deal by the Rockefellers or somebody else, a ton of gold really set the imagination of the whole country off, and the gold rush was on.
The reporter, Beriah Brown of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, had been modest, as it turned out. The ship, in fact, brought in not one, but 2 tons of gold. And the gold stampede was on. First in 1898, through Alaska's Dyea and the Chilkoot Pass, through Skagway and the White Pass, over to the headwaters of the Yukon River, and on 500 miles to Dawson. 40,000 streamed in, most of them soft and inexperienced, fighting privation and death to get to the gold fast before anyone else did. Frank Young was there, a young boy of 6, on the shoulders of his father, over Chilkoot Pass in 98.
In 1898, my dad, with the family, went into Klondike diggings by the way of the Dyea and Chilkoot Pass. And I, as a youngster, about 6 or 7 years old, made that trip with my folks. We'd come down the Yukon into Dawson in the spring of 98. And my mother was with my dad. And we stayed in Dawson a couple of years there when we heard of the gold strike in the Tanana Valley at Fairbanks. So my dad packed the family up and we arrived here in May 1905. And since those years, I've been practically in the interior of Alaska here. And as I grew up, I took in many interior stampedes, as we call it, or gold strikes. And I did some good and some bad.
And Frank Young stayed as did thousands more who first came to the Yukon and Alaska. But settling the new country wasn't in their minds then. They had gold fever. And gold was discovered all across Alaska, from Dawson to Fairbanks to Nome.
Well, the gold fever in them days was known all over the United States, or most of the United States. And everybody wanted to get in on the big stampede, try and make their fortune or their stake, and then get out of the country. Most of them figured they'd come in here and make a pile and then get out, get back to the United States, as they used to say in them days. Oh, there was lots of them liked the country and stayed with it, like my family.
There aren't many of the original gold stampeders left in Alaska today, but their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are everywhere. Frank Young and a few others are still there to tell us about it.
I went over in that Vault Creek many years ago when I was a young man, and it looked like a pretty good prospect in there. There was an old fellow there that I knew had found pretty good colors. So he told me where to go and sink a hole. I don't know whether he figured he's giving me a bum steer or what, but I went there and I happened to land on some pretty good pay. Mm-hmm. I made a few thousand dollars there when I was a young man, and most of it I invested back in mining machinery and whatnot. And in the long run, I wound up, not too rich.
What happened?
Well, I kept at it a little too long, got into some deep ground and wet ground where it was pretty near impossible to work it. And that kind of operation cost money, and eventually I drained the poke.
He found pretty good colors. He hit pretty good pay, which meant he found some good quality gold. But then he drained the poke. He spent all his money. Though a few gold prospectors got rich, that wasn't the luck of most. Most were like Frank Young. They were hardy men who wanted to stake their own claim on life and the future. This breed found more than gold in Alaska. They came from everywhere and found a way of life in a challenging country among people of their own kind. And they stayed and conquered the wilderness and the cold. Alaska was made a territory of the United States in 1912, and the first territorial legislature met in 1913. The battle for statehood began in 1916, but it wasn't until 1959 that the great land of the North became the 49th state of the Union. By 1930, when the price of mining went up and the price of gold stayed down, mining almost died out. It took fantastic sums of money to haul the expensive equipment by dog team or behind horses hundreds of miles into the wilderness. That's when another colorful group of Alaskans came along and the era of the bush pilot began. We'll tell you more about them and more about the Eskimo, the Indian, and the sourdough in our next program.
This has been the first of four programs on Alaska, the Last Frontier. The history, the people, the legend, and the promise. Next week at this time, more on the people of Alaska. Then in succeeding programs, the legend and the promise. This program was written and narrated by Rhett Turner and directed by Roy Depew. This is Jack Weitzel speaking for the Voice of America, Studio One.